So, Richard, you've climbed into this airplane with this bozo, and it's gotten more and more sort of, you know, off the charts to the point where you feel you really got to step in and do something. How much are you stepping in here? Is this a demand, a request, or something in between? And how are you handling it?
You know, I think what we should keep in mind here is that it's Phil's airplane. And Phil gave me PIC authority in his airplane so he can rescind it just as quickly, right? So I'm cognizant of the fact that I'm flying in his airplane. But as I mentioned in this scenario, I never want any pilot flying with me to be uncomfortable. So I'll always yield to the more conservative approach, even if it's not what I really want to do. And I expect the same sort of consideration when I fly with another pilot. So I would avoid that conflict by being suggestive. And then if you can't suggest an outcome you're comfortable with, then you just, it's never happened, but maybe you would politely ask, how about you land and drop me off?
I agree that the bigger chicken wins the argument. Whoever is uncomfortable, you got to respect their feelings among peers. So if a fellow pilot says, hey, let's get this thing on the ground, I think the right thing to do is to respect that. But a couple thoughts on this. First, you know, we didn't talk much about it's a new engine. You know, new engines make me nervous. There appears to be a mechanical problem. You know, infant mortality is a significant concern. The carb temp, you know, I'm not terribly concerned about that. I think that's a red herring. On a Lycoming engine, they're not terribly susceptible to carburetor ice. I'm sure it happens. I've never seen it. And then the biggest issue I've got with your sort of split between two and four is that, hey, if we can't resolve this problem in the air and we go ahead and land, I'm not taking off again. You know, I'm highly unlikely to resolve the problem to anyone's satisfaction on the ground. If we land, that's fine, but we're looking for another ride home. So that's my two cents on this.
You know, the what you said is the first thing that got my attention in this scenario. We have a Cardinal with a new engine, and new engines, I mean, I'll take a thing that's blown 1,000 hours past TBO and feel comfortable in it before an engine that has 100 hours. 100 hours, I am anxious about the engine and whether it's really, really stabilized. So when you have a rough engine, when I'm already suspect of it, I already know in my heart of hearts, so to speak, that there's something that needs fixing. It's not carb ice. This is an early engine, so I'm immediately going to something deeper in the engine again. Maybe a cracked spark plug when they put it in. They over-torqued it. And what's really funny about this scenario is I was up with a guy I owned a 182 in. We co-owned the airplane. I got out of the partnership, but we were still flying together, and we went up for him to do hood work for a commercial commercial training. He gets under the hood, and we start getting a rough running engine. And we did the same thing. We did the mag check to see, well, what's going on, you know? And finally he was like, again, we mutually agreed. Now, let's just go back to the airport. There's something wrong, because it didn't pan out. And it turned out to be a crack in the distributor cap and some fried points. So, I mean, we had a fairly significant problem. And again, it was easy because we both mutually agreed, let's just bail on this one. I think most pilots are cut from the same kind of cloth where we're going to be likely to be cautious, and shouldn't take too much convincing. But here's your courtship. If it takes a lot of convincing, this is obviously a non-starter as a relationship. So right there, this is a good trial from that standpoint. So I like the idea of, again, doing the airborne mag check, because it's a really good opportunity to do some troubleshooting to see, really get to what the root is. And if you have an engine monitor, all the better, because now you have some real data. I'm going to land if there's services. If there are no services, this is going to be one of those, again, this is a relationship issue. We're going to have a little discussion here about, are we comfortable continuing over Gatorville here? And I'd rather be on the ground.
Well, definitely something needs to be fixed with the engine, but I think something also needs to be fixed with pilot and command responsibility here. I can just imagine myself sitting in the right seat of an airplane, and all of a sudden the pilot of the aircraft pulls out a hood and says, okay, you're in charge now. And I think a response to that might be, well, if you want, we can, you know, you can do some hood work. You retain pilot command responsibility, and I am a safety pilot, but you are still here to make the decisions. As Richard said, it's just as likely that if you had tried to exert your pilot in command authority and tell him what to do, that he would rescind that right away. So I think you do have a fine line to walk there. As far as the engine is concerned, I think that troubleshooting a situation in the air is always a good idea if you have the altitude and the capability of doing so. And it would make the outcome of that test would make a big difference about whether or not you did land right away, or if you thought, well, I can bypass the swamps and fly up the highway but get back home with the airplane.
I agree with your solution, Richard, to do the troubleshooting in the air. There is a significant hazard to doing an airborne mag check, and that is that if your mag has failed and you select that magneto, the engine's going to quit. Now, the natural reaction there is to quickly turn that mag switch right back on, which is going to produce a very loud backfire and perhaps damage your engine. So the technique, everybody should understand the proper technique to do an in-flight mag check is to turn it and let go of the switch immediately. That way, if the engine does fail, you'll hopefully remember now to pull out the mixture control. As it's windmilling, it should clear the fuel. Now you can go back to both mags and now increase the mixture control, and the engine will resume operation without that big backfire. So I don't know how many people do in-flight mag checks, but there is a hazard that you could blow your muffler off the airplane.
I agree with you guys where I want pavement underneath me when I have a rough running engine. So I would have gone for Wachula, and I would have gone ahead and troubleshot over the top of the airport. And if after the leaning procedure it didn't get any better, I would have sat there for maybe 15 or 20 minutes circling above the airport. Is it getting worse? Is it staying the same? Do I have enough confidence that it's going to take me back home? Because, yeah, the swamps are one way, but if I look at going southbound around the highway, now there's a city there, and not sure I want to put the people at Port Charlotte at risk of an airplane that might have an engine that, and an airplane is going to become a glider. So it's just one of those things where I want to make sure the engine, if it is running not at 100%, that it's at least stable, and I think it's going to get me back for 20 minutes.
Now, one thing, because I know people will probably bring it up in the hangar, and actually, Tom, you were talking about this with me last night, this whole concept of infant mortality, there's some people out there who would point to statistics and say, hey, you know, that's actually an old wives' tale. The engine runs for 10 hours on a test stand. Anything that's going to break, it breaks then, and it's no more likely to break, you know, out over the airport. And that may here be kind of a red herring because you have a problem whether it was 100 hours into an engine or 1,000 hours into an engine. It sort of doesn't matter at this point, right? You know, you've got an issue you're dealing with. But I want to go back to kind of what you were saying there, Michael, of like, okay, you're circling over the airport. It's not getting worse, but it didn't get better. And boy, do we land here where there might be services. Four Flight says there is, but who knows if, you know, Billy has gone home for the weekend. Or do we continue, not maybe over the swamps, but following the roads and working our way back? It's 20 minutes, a direct flight. So the two sides of the triangle, 40 minutes. How do we decide that?
Well, I also think you have to look at the severity, right? Is it just a rumble and, hey, I think something's wrong. It might be a little carb ice. It might be a bad plug. It might be a little bit of a mag problem. But it's nothing that I'm really worried about. I just know that it's not optimum at the moment. Or is it shaking itself off the mountain? I can't see the instrument panel. There's a different way to look at it, right? So if it's shaking itself silly, well, guess what? I'm going to go to the ground. If it's just a little rumble, but it doesn't seem to get any worse, and it's just something that I can feel it in the seat of my pants, then I'd be more apt to see if it changes, try to troubleshoot it. If it doesn't, but it stays stable, follow a road through the swamp back home, take my 20 minutes.
And that's kind of a gut check, not from a safety perspective, right? Because we've kind of already determined in that scenario, you're over the runway, you can land there, that's a given. You think the engine's running well enough to get you home, so that now becomes a safe option. Now what's running in my mind is, what's the potential damage I'm doing to this engine? And in this conversation, I chatted with a few A&Ps over this very scenario, Jeff, when you and I were building it. And they were pretty unanimous that a rough running engine, you got to be really careful because you could be doing some serious long-term damage to the engine. You just don't know. And so that's, but it's hard to say, Michael, to your point, how rough is it running, you know? So, but that's a consideration there.
Yeah, I think that's one of the questions. Is it carb ice rough or is it, like you say, rattling your jaws and making you anxious rough? The one thing on, this is a question, I think, on doing mag checks, airborne mag checks, you know, one of the things is, again, do you have a multi-cylinder monitor? That gives you a huge amount more diagnostic information. But I've always gone below 65%, not above 75% for fear of detonation. So if I'm doing a lean in-flight mag check, particularly lean of peak, I'm doing it below 65% to avoid damage to the engine. And I don't know if that's from where I learned that, but that's when I saw in the scenario we're doing a mag check and lean a peak at 75% power, I'm already, it's like, I would never do that.
You know, the harder question for me is if you play this out a little bit. What if you you switch mags and you go to the right mag and it runs perfectly fine? Now you've isolated the problems to where it's the left mag or a spark plug on the left mag, but it's like, is it legit to fly across the swamp on one? If the engine continues to run okay on both and it clears up on the right mag, personally, I think I would return home on one mag.
Well, yeah, that's an interesting thing of do you, you've got one mag that's a problem and it's clearly running rough only on that mag. But then if you take that out of the equation and it's running, you know, we have two magnetos for a reason.
Right.
You know?
If I had one dead mag and I had one okay mag, then land. If I have one good mag and the other one runs rough, I'll continue flight on that.
On the good mag.
On the good mag, knowing that if I go to both, it'll, you know, it's likely to still run.
Yeah, Dave's exactly right. We have that step on the emergency procedures checklist to isolate magnetos and see what the impact is, but we never talk about what do you do with that information which you have.
Right.
So this may be a perfectly good situation where I've got things smoothed down. I can re-lean the mixture so that it runs nice and smooth, follow the highway around, I would in that case, but go back home with it then.
I had a similar situation, Dave, to that scenario. I had an airplane that was really running rough, backfiring intermittently. It would do that for 10 seconds, and then it would run smooth for a period of time. And I chose not to try individual mags simply because I said, well, both must be better. I should have tried individual mags because what I had was a internal damage in a magneto. And if I'd have taken it out of the picture, the engine would have run smoothly. It got me to an airport, but...
And I think that's one of the places where you were talking about the fact that you can get damage. You know, if you're getting timing off on one side,
that's what was happening.
You know, when the timing is off, you really are running the risk of damaging the aircraft. You know, because that's going to really, again, there's a reason it's rough. It's hitting the spark at the wrong part of the stroke. It's loaded with gas in the wrong places. You know, that's one reason why I like the idea of going on one mag, because smooth and half of as efficient or with less burn is still smooth.
Right. Now, I'm curious, too, for this group, we've got a lot of experienced pilots in the room who fly with other pilots, either who are students or just someone on board, or even maybe both experienced pilots who are flying together. How many of you define the roles at all formally before takeoff? Or how many just kind of work it out and see how it goes in the air?
I do every time. If I'm acting as a flight instructor, part of the briefing to my client is that you act as though you were a pilot. You are pilot in command of the aircraft, and unless, of course, for some legal reason they are unable to fulfill that role. We define that you are the pilot in command of the aircraft, and even though I'm on board this airplane, act as though you were alone. If you see something that you feel needs attention, if you feel like you need to do a go-around, if you need to do a missed approach, anything like that all, act as though you're alone in the airplane. Now, tell me what you're doing. We may talk about it later on the ground, but you will not be wrong. Because I do fly with a lot of people in beach airplanes when I am not acting in the capacity as a flight instructor, let's go for a ride and look at my new avionics or whatever. I go out of my way to say, I'm not acting as a flight instructor. You are the pilot in command of this aircraft. I'm here as a resource for you. If you need me to do anything up to and including take control of the airplane, I will do so when you tell me, but you're the pilot in command. And I make that formal statement every time I get in an airplane with someone.
Anybody else have that counterpoint to that, just kind of working it out in the air?
I'm a lot less formal. I got to say that, I probably should be more like Tom in this area. Usually the rules are pretty defined. Obviously, if it's an instructional flight, it's different. But it's like the hard one there is when you're flying with two peers. Then it's like that's to me is the situation in which you could really benefit from spelling out the responsibilities a little more. But that's good food for thought.
Well, and that's really the situation I'm talking about, where I'm flying with another, usually in my case, a Bonanza or a Baron owner. I'm flying with another pilot. I'm not doing this in the context of an instructional flight. So I just want to make it clear that we both understand what the roles are there.
You know, one of the things that I thought was also really fascinating and as part of a dynamic we do face a lot, you go up with somebody who you just got to know. You don't really know their... You know them, you got along with them right away, you hit it off, they're a pilot, you're a pilot, you go up together, and now we have all these interesting expectations. They may think you are more experienced and are deferring to you, and so they're not making the decisions without telling you they're not making the decisions, or they're making decisions because they think you're judging them and they're trying to please you and they're trying to demonstrate their skill set and how much where they're at. You know, there's a lot of ego and just jockeying for understanding who we are and how we're going to get along together. And it murks up that relationship, and people make different decisions with another pilot in the cockpit than they would on their own. And that's one of the things to be aware of. And particularly when you're starting a relationship, again, they could be trying to demonstrate how smart they are or how good they are. And likewise, you may be holding back. I don't want to criticize this guy's flying because I just met him. And that is, I think, a dynamic that's in the cockpit very frequently.
I'll tell you a quick story about flying with Richard McSpadden for the first time. And it's like, okay, I got to say that was very intimidating for me because it's like, okay, flight instructor, you're going to go fly with Thunderbird lead and you're going to check this guy out in a new to him GA airplane. And I was just showing him how we pulled the plane out of the hangar, how we check it out. It was a Beech Sierra. And it's got this funky little tow bar, and I'm backing up, and I'm pulling up with the tow bar. I'm showing him how to do it. The tow bar comes unloose. I fall on my butt, and it's like, okay, CFI's off to a great start, you know, trying to impress Thunderbird 1 in this. But and I would, frankly, you know, Richard and Michael in particular, I got to think that you probably have this situation a lot where you're flying with people who are trying to impress you. And I'm just curious how you handle that.
It's funny. I a lot of people will fly in our school, and I'll get with them, and I tell them, I'm going to be the easiest guy that you're going to fly with, and our instructor will be way harder on you. And I say, hey, listen, I'm here really to check on my instructor, not on you. And if I see something that is deficient in your flying, it's going to go back to him or her, not to you. And I just emphasize the fact that I'm an expert in flying upside down, low to the ground, and between pylons. But that doesn't mean I'm an expert in flying what I'm flying. And I'm like any other flight instructor in this airplane. There's people with more hours in this airplane than I have. I'm good in it. I'm not the best. I'm probably not the worst. But treat me as you would anybody else, and I'll treat you. And quite frankly, the mission is to learn. After that objective is completed, is essentially to have fun. And that's why we're doing this. And I tell them that. I'm like, hey, I want you to learn things that you wouldn't learn from anybody else, and I want you to have fun doing it, and we'll do it in a safe manner. And that sort of I want them to relax in the plane so I can see their best when they're flying.
Yeah, I had a story like that, Dave, when I was flying with the team, and I was Thunderbird 1, and I came home, and I was flying on vacation with somebody, and we were going up to fly in their airplane. And right before we took off, he says, all right, he's going through a really nice pre-takeoff brief, And he says, so if we have any problems airborne, I'll give you the airplane and you'll, you know, take control and bring us down. I'm like, wait, dude, time out. I'm pretty good at flying an F-16, but I know nothing about flying this airplane you're flying. So if we have a problem, I'm counting on you to bring us back safely. And so I since saw him a couple years later, and he said that was a really good lesson learned for him in terms of PIC, no matter who's flying with you, right? So an enjoyable experience for both of us.
You know, maybe it's like flying over Florida, like missing the swamp for the gator instead of the forest for the trees, and not unclear what to focus on. But I keep coming back to here flying, you know, a jet into the Everglades because you were so focused on what this one light was. And maybe the whole takeaway from this scenario is about you've got multiple people in the cockpit. It's all about teamwork and communication, right? How are you going to use the human resources you have productively when a situation arises that's maybe not a burning fire, but could deteriorate into something terrible, or could be a non-event and a good story, and maybe you and Phil eventually will laugh about it because you are partners in the airplane because, hey, we worked together, we worked it out, we brought the plane either down here or home, and we all got to go and fly another day.